All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the 411 Ground and Pound MMA podcast. We are your weekly look into the wide, wacky, wonderful world of mixed martial arts. My name is Robert Winfrey, and thank you very, very much for listening. I always appreciate that. On the agenda tonight, well, we got stuff. We actually have some stuff. Last night, the UFC had some more warehouse fights, couple of decent fights in there. So we'll talk about UFC on ESPN plus 98, or UFC Vegas 90 if you prefer. We will talk about preview for UFC 300. We finally have a good card. Boy, I hope nothing bad happens to it. Then some news. There's some Jon Jones stuff, because it's been a while since we've had to do that. A little bit of matchmaking, maybe some minor behind-the-scenes stuff that I don't think is gonna catch anyone too off guard, and we got some news, so that's pleasant. All right, but yeah, that's it. So any way you can interact with the product is always appreciated. Like, comment, subscribe, star rating, written review, sharing around, whatever is applicable to your podcast platform of choice, your social media platform of choice, or to your just social circle in real life. That all works very, very well. So. Any of that you can do to help the show, always, always, always appreciated. So, all right, let's jump right in then, shall we? UFC on ESPN plus 98. For those of you who might be newer, at the top of the show, I am tracking my predictions this year. How did we do? We did okay. 8-4. Which was the one of these that got me a little bit? Well, okay, first of all, before I get into full of that, we had four fighters miss weight. Alexander Hernandez missed weight. Then both fighters on our first fight of the night, that would be Melissa Mullins and Nora Kronol, they both missed weight. And then Cynthia Calvillo missed weight. And Cynthia Calvillo missed weight, and the fight was canceled. So that fell apart. So, because it didn't fall apart the day of, anything that happens on weigh-in day is just canceled and doesn't count. I do have a fizzled column for anything that, because I don't mind tracking events that, fights that fall out day of just as an oddity, because it doesn't happen that often, but it's happened twice already this year, so see how common that winds up becoming. Of the ones I got wrong, I think only two I probably should have gotten correct. One of them was just a close fight. We'll talk about that in a minute or two. Almeida over Budka, I probably should have got right. For the record. That's the only one I really think you should have been able to see that one coming. Because Kronol over Mullins, if I look, I don't do a tremendous amount of tape study for the first fight of the night. And I have a life. But that one, I hemmed and hawed a little bit, so I'm not going to beat myself up about that one too badly. It's mostly the Almeida one that I probably should have had that one. Everything else, yeah, just kind of played the way it played. So 8-4 on the evening. That's fine. Year to date is now 99-48. Three no contests, two fights fizzled. Again, for those keeping track of that stat, which doesn't play into the actual math of this. No contests, kind of do, but. Or at least I keep track of them. Again, the fizzle is for my own thing. No contest or official results of fights. So, if I'd gotten one more right, could have hit triple digits. I was kind of hoping to get to triple digits before UFC 300. But, there were the last two events before this one. Actually, the last three. I have not done great. So, any of those three, I could have done better on and been where I wanted to be here. But. 8-4 for an event. I will take it. I'll take 2-1. I just want to be better than a coin flip. That's my goal by the end of the year. I don't know how the math's going to shake out on that, but right now, again, 99-48. I'm okay with that. I'd like it to be better, but I'm not going to complain. I'm not going to complain too much about that one. All right. Fights in particular. Main event. Brendan Allen defeats Curtis Jackson via split decision. There was a 48-47 either way, and then a 49-46 for Allen. That drew some consternation on the internet. I was 49-46 Allen when I was doing this live. Caveat there, I think the third round in particular, I think I got wrong. But some of the perils of trying to score while you're doing coverage, they kind of showed up. So my scoring is imperfect, and it's usually only after I've seen something a second time, or usually after seeing it, whether or not I'll really stand by my scoring there. I think 3-2 either way is perfectly fine. This was, I thought, the fight of the night. It was not officially, because reasons. There's always reasons. Mostly pertaining to, whoever hands those things out on the night. How did this go? Again, good fight. It's worth your time to look this up. Early on, Allen doing some kicking. His takedown game was okay. The problem was he really, really struggled to hold position or to mount serious attacks. He had a few moments when he did. I don't mean to say never, but he was not able to really control Curtis for long periods of time or do a ton of damage. Now, enough to win, again, enough to win three of the rounds for two of the three judges, but close. Curtis's boxing still pretty darn good. If he would mix in a few more kicks, man. He showed a head kick a couple of times in this fight, and it surprised Allen a little bit. I don't think he ever landed it flush, but he got close. His body work is always very good. Allen slowed a little bit. He rallied, but he the body work was paying off a little bit there. Just a good fight. It's a pretty darn good fight. Ultimately, I think what really cost Curtis, he seems to have torn his hamstring in the fifth. Well, he's talked a little bit about this. Says he injured it in the second, and then some exchange in the fifth round aggravated it. So unfortunately for him, the last couple of seconds of the last like 10-ish seconds of this fight, he's limping on that right leg and against the fence, and he looks like he's been badly hurt. Now, a torn hamstring is miserable. Never had one myself, but I've known people. Miserable. The fact that he was standing at all, like, my hat's off to him, man. Because if he'd done what a lot of people would have done and just collapsed, that they would have stopped it. But he maintained. Good for him. But that was a really close round, man. And letting Allen have a big flurry when you look hurt at the very end of it might have cost him that fight. Again, really unfortunate for him. I like Curtis. And he turned in a very good performance. The fact that he did this on short notice, that's very, very commendable. After the fight, Allen said he wants a title shot. He's been banging that drum for a little bit. He's got a six-fight winning streak now, which is certainly laudable. I think five of those are finishes. Either five or four are finishes. Unfortunately for him, he's being hampered by the level of opposition. He was supposed to fight Marvin Vettori here, and that would have done his career a world of good if he'd won. If he'd fought Marvin Vettori and won, which not a guarantee, Marvin Vettori is a very tough out. But beating a guy ranked that highly would have been big. This is a good win. I don't mean to imply that it's not. I understand his calling for a title shot. I really do. But he's gonna have to beat somebody ranked highly at least once before he gets that. And that's unfortunate. I mean, I think they all but confirmed that we're getting Duplessis and Adesanya next. And look, my respect for what Israel Adesanya is capable of doing is fairly well documented at this point. I don't think he deserves that shot. Sean Strickland wants a rematch. Their fight was okay, but I mean, I'm a little bit sick of immediate rematches personally. And much as their fight was close, and it wasn't an all-time great fight, and Strickland doesn't have a big body of work in the division. I know they're just trying to capitalize on some of the heat that you had kind of generated between DDP and Izzy. Okay. I understand it. I don't think he, I'm not knocking Adesanya. I'm really not. I like him as a fighter, but I don't think he has meritocratically earned this shot. The dude is like, what, 2-1 in his last three title fights? Might be three and sorry, it's like 1-2. Because he lost to Pereira, beat Pereira, lost to Strickland. I'm sorry, man, that this doesn't compute to me. On the purely meritocratic side. But middleweight also doesn't have another like really big contender right now. Strickland's, making noise about maybe going to boxing since he didn't get the rematch, and I wish him the best of luck if he chooses to. Fair play to you, good sir. Robert Whittaker is gonna fight Khamzat Chimaev because Robert Whittaker is that guy, to use that phrase. Whittaker is that guy. And DDP's already finished Whittaker. It's just in kind of a weird spot. So I'm not gonna call Israel Adesanya a nostalgia act, but the argue if you in the absence of a compelling argument, even any kind of compelling argument, the UFC falling back on tenure and hey, we've got some, B-roll footage of you two getting in each other's faces. Yeah, you kind of just got to roll with that, I guess. So Allen's gonna have to fight somebody else. I don't know who. They might try to do him and Sean Strickland. I don't know if Strickland's gonna be down for that. Listen, man, middleweight's just in a weird spot, and I'm not trying to be overly negative here. It's where they are. Let's have a look at it real fast, actually. Yeah, so you've got Du Plessis. Strickland's the number one contender because reasons. Then you got Adesanya, then Whittaker, Cannonier, Vettori, but then Brendan Allen. So, Cannonier, maybe? I don't know what's up with him. I mean, if you don't mind me going very briefly through this whole division, you'll see what I mean when I say it's just in kind of a weird place. So, DDP, Strickland, Adesanya, Whittaker, Jared Cannonier, Marvin Vettori, Brendan Allen, Paulo Costa, Nassourdine Imavov, Roman Dolidze, Jack Hermanson, Khamzat Chimaev, Anthony Hernandez, Paul Craig, Chris Curtis, and Caio Bajalio. I'm not here to say that this is a bad division. I'm really not. We're just kind of in a point of flux where Chimaev, Hernandez, and Bajalio in particular are kind of trying to rise. Vettori's a young guy, but he's been here for quite a while already. And then you got the old guard that's like, okay, fine, you want my spot, come take it. And occasionally they've been turning them back. And you can't knock the guys for, if you can't get over the hump, you can't get over the hump. I mean, look, if I was going to talk about a division in a bad spot, light heavyweight's not great, and heavyweight is kind of a mess. And we'll get into more of that a little bit later. So Curtis, hopefully that injury is not too serious. I mean, clearly it's not. Clearly it's a, somewhat serious injury. I hope it's not like a long recovery or anything. So hopefully speedy recovery to him. Allen's probably going to need one more, but that's where we are. All right. Next up, co-main event: Damon Jackson against Alexander Hernandez. Jackson wins via split. 229-28 for Jackson. That's what I had. And a 30-27 for Hernandez that I'm not so happy with. I'm not up in arms over it, but look, man, the first two rounds were kind of close. Not horribly close, but kind of close. And I think Hernandez won, and Hernandez won the third. Not decisively, but I think everybody gave him the third, right? You know, make me look this up specifically. Let's have a look at the official scorecards. Jackson and Hernandez. Yeah, Hernandez universally won the third round, which I think is fair. I'm not up in arms over every media who submits was 29-28 Jackson. Again, that's what I had. I thought he won the first two rounds. I do acknowledge that at least one of those, which was the really, one of those was quite close, I thought. I still thought Jackson won it, but there was one of them that felt a little closer than the other. So, again, I don't love 30-27 at all for Hernandez. I think 29-28 Hernandez is maybe a bit more defensible, but just a solid performance out of Jackson. Did what he normally does. Okay-ish striking, got tagged a few times. Got the takedowns. Got some decent enough work done in from top position. Nothing major, but enough to kind of tip things in his scorecard, in his favor. So that was that. Good enough win for him. Hernandez. That man has he still not won at featherweight? So he dropped. Yeah, he hasn't. So he drops to featherweight for. He returns to featherweight for the first time in the UFC in 2022, and gets stopped in the second round by Billy Quarantillo. He goes back up to lightweight to beat Jim Miller, goes back to featherweight, loses to Bill Algeo. Here misses weight and loses to Damon Jackson. I don't understand the featherweight experiment going on here with him. I don't think this is an ideal weight class for him. But I don't know, maybe that's just me. But speaking of featherweights, moving on. Jose Chepe Mariscal defeated Morgan Charrier via split decision. There were two 29-28s for Mariscal, which I think that's fine. I know some people were a little butthurt about this one. And a 30-27 for Charrier. I think I was 20. What was I officially? Because let me start with, this was your fight of the night. And I would have given it, be very clear, I would have given it to Alan Curtis. This, however, is not a bad choice. Oh, no, wait. I was 29-28 Mariscal. For some reason, I thought I scored that for Chartier. Third round, super close, and was probably the decider. This was a good fight. It was a fun little 15-minute scrap. Some wild positional changes, some exchanges on the feet. Just good stuff all around from both guys. This would be the other one I think that I would say look up. This again, this is not the most technical thing in the world. There's some good technique to be had here. But it's just kind of a fun little scrap, so it was a good one. Good, again, I scored it from our skull, but some people, I'm just out of idle curiosity, because I haven't seen some of the other reactions to this one. A lot of people 29-28 Charrier in the media. Again, that first round in particular felt, especially like rethinking or like looking back at it, that was super close. I'm once again not up in arms over this one. 29-28, either way is fine, in all honesty. Mariscal turning into a little something at featherweight here. I mean, his debut, short notice, up at lightweight, and he had what I constantly say is like the most entertaining parking lot fight you'll ever see when he fought Trevor Peak. Featherweight, where he kind of belongs. Look, he had some trouble with Jack Farr early. Excuse me, Farr, Jack Jenkins, Jack Farr. But ultimately, got him to injure his arm on a takedown, and that's a win. Competitive fight here, but I don't think him winning is wrong. Again, 29-28 either way. I'm not taking issue with it. And I don't even really hate 30-27 for Chartier, so. Good little fight. Good little fight. Lightweight, Ignacio Bahamondes defeated Christos Yagos via head kick, 334 the first. This was our only finish on the main card, by the way. Dude, there were a whopping four finishes all night on this card. And the first three were the first three fights of the evening. After that, oh boy, we were going long. So, kind of just what I thought. Bahamondes is a fun fighter. Got some range, used it pretty effectively. He's got some defensive issues if people can close on him. Like a lot of tall guys, he kind of leans. That's a recipe for disaster in some circumstances. But kept Yagos kind of at distance, hit him with a wheel kick at one point, staggered him. He'd kind of beaten him up a little bit, then Yagos switches to open stance, L steps to his right, and as soon as that back foot comes down, if you never L stepped, it's you make an L with your feet. So generally, it's front foot comes to back foot steps out at a 90 or something approximating a 90. As soon as that back foot hit, Bahamondes had that left kick up on the side of his head. Bahamondes, after the fight, said he would like to fight on the Noche card. They're going to be in the Sphere for that in September. Not that's not that, they're calling it Noche. I say book him and Daniel Zellhuber. Those guys are both tall for the weight. I'm stealing this idea, by the way. They're both tall. They're both Mexican. They're both rangy as heck. Let the two lanky boys go at it. Again, I'm stealing that from a few other people on Twitter. I think it's a good idea. Zellhuber might be a little bit ahead of Bahamondes overall, but wait, is Bahamondes, is he Mexican or is he Peruvian? Oh, he's Chilean. Why did I think he was? Wow, I should have remembered that. He's not. Is he the only Chilean fighter in the UFC at the moment? He might be. I don't think he was the first. I think the first guy they got from Chile went like 1 and 2 and got cut. But he might be the only one at the moment. So my apologies, man. My sincere apologies. Zellhuber's Mexican. But Bahamondes is not. My bad. No, seriously, my bad. But either way, I think those two make for that would be kind of fun. So toss me in with the group that thinks that's a good idea. And kicking off the main card, Charlie Campbell defeated Trevor Peak via unanimous decision, 30-27 across the board. This was okay. This wasn't a barn burner, but it was okay. Peak just tried to push a little bit of a pace. He just has not figured out how to marry his meme fighter tendencies and throw in the big standing hammer fist, which everybody jokes about those. And it bothers me when people laugh at it, not because I don't get it, but because that's a perfectly valid strike. It's not my favorite strike in the world, but you really want to tell me that's a bad thing to throw? You don't have to worry about your wrist alignment necessarily. There's a little bit less. There's actually, if you're in MMA gloves, there's like no padding on the sides there. You're getting some more force behind it. Again, when you do the boxing and the big gloves, well, boxing, you actually can't hammer fist. It's very specific about which part you can hit with. And that's kind of, in some respects, it's kind of carried over to punch philosophy in non-boxing sports. And they're not the, again, they're not the same sport. So it doesn't bother me that he throws those. It bothers me how he throws them, or some of the other stuff that goes along with it. But hey, I'm using standing hammer fists as part of my striking flurries and combinations. Dude, that's good. That's not a bad idea. Got to make it work, but it's not a bad idea. But, he's trying to figure out how to marry that with, actual technique and good strategy and all that stuff. And Campbell just a little bit ahead of him. So Campbell gets the win. Solid fight. Next up, welterweights. Alex Morono defeated Courtney McGee via unanimous decision. 29-28 across the board. Not a lot of. Morono had a good first round, he usually does, but he tends to slow a bit as the fight goes on. Certainly his movement slows. These two guys, they beat each other up to the body. Morono just landed a little bit the better punches to the head. Second round, Morono jumps for a guillotine. McGee escapes, spends the majority of the round on top, kind of beating him up from full guard. Third round, Morono back to fighting on the outside a little bit. Enough to get the win. I was surprised at how competitive McGee looked here. I was ready to write him off, but apparently he had neck issues that he got fixed surgically and might have given him a little bit more life in the UFC. We'll have to see. I mean, they might still just cut him anyway because the UFC is the UFC, but based on this, wouldn't hate one more out of him. Like the last couple of fights before this, I was ready to, I don't think he needs to continue taking damage like that, but if part of his chin issues were, again, neck damage related, and he's got that sorted, again, wouldn't hit one more in this kind of a spot, but the guy's almost 40. It is coming to a close for him sooner rather than later. Heavyweights, Łukasz Drzeszki defeats Walter Walker. Unanimous decision, 29-28 across the boards. Crappy heavyweight fight. Nothing to see here. Women's bantamweight Norma Dumont defeated Jermaine Durandamy via unanimous decision, 29-28 across the boards. Round one to Dumont, round two to Durandamy, round three to Dumont. Not much to see here. Durandamy still struggles to get up, especially if she's taken down in open space. If you get her down against the fence and she can quickly go through the wall walking sequence, she's okay. If you make her scoot herself to the fence and then try to start wall walking from there, a bit more difficult for her. Yeah, Dumont got takedowns in one and three, did not get any in two, got the win. Bantamweight, this was supposed to be Victor Hugo and Alatong Hele. However, week of the fight, Alatong Hele had some kind of illness, pulled out. Pedro Falcao stepped in, like 3 days' notice. Falcao made weight. If someone wasn't going to make weight, you'd think it'd be the guy stepping in on 3 days' notice, but no, that man made weight, so good on him. Ultimately, Victor Hugo wins unanimous decision, 2-29-28 and a 30-27. Falcao tried to make this interesting. I think the first round could have gone to Falcao, but he just wasn't in like hard 3 round shape. And on 3 days' notice, very few people are. So Hugo kind of stuffed the rest of his takedowns after that. Did okay. Did a little bit too much backing up for me. Did Hugo? Not much of a combination striker. Some of this I'm going to give him a little bit of a pass on because late notice of play, opponent shift, and Falcao did not fight at all like Alatong Hele does. So some understandable things going on here, but they do bear noting. Also at bantamweight, John Matsumoto defeated Dan Argueda via guillotine choke, 4:59 of the second. Matsumoto did okay in the first. I think Argueda still took it, but Argueda, relentless wrestling attack, but Matsumoto, once he got a feel for how he likes to control, able to wall walk, do some good work in the clinch, break out, better striker. Third round, Argueda gets a little bit too aggressive looking for a double leg, kind of falls into a guillotine choke, and he taps just before he goes to sleep. You can see this. Round's almost over. He's fighting. But It's an arm in guillotine, but he's on the wrong hip. Matsumoto clearly knows what he's doing with this. And he taps, and then his arm goes limp. So this was like he tapped right before he went to sleep. For anyone doing the, oh, if only he'd held on. If they go to end of the round, Matsumoto lets go, and Argueda is unconscious from the choke, we're done. Like, there was no saving that one. That's a pretty good all-around outing from Matsumoto here. This was a solid debut for him. Middleweight Cesar Almeida defeated Dylan Budka via TKO punches 2:13 of the second. Wrestler tried to take da Almeida down, had some success in the first, but one of these things, guys, if you're going to wrestle especially some of these high-level kickboxers that are coming transitioning to MMA, not saying don't wrestle them. I'm saying these guys know they have to be prepared for this, and there's enough people out there right now that know how to use the fence to make your life miserable. If you're not an exceptional fence wrestler or have takedowns out in space that do not allow them to get to the fence, everybody's kind of learned that that thing is your ally. So if your double leg carries them to the fence, they're probably going to be okay again, unless you are not just a good wrestler. Wrestling against the fence is an entirely different skill set. Entirely is a bit strong, but it's a world of difference. It is not the same thing as open space wrestling at all, almost. And a lot of these kickboxers coming over, Adesanya, Pereira, now Almeida, like, there's quite a few. They figured out, okay, maybe in open space, I'm never going to be able to out-wrestle you. You put this thing behind me, you give me a good, I mean, how much to be competent at stopping yourself from getting taken down if you're against the fence or basic wall walking, you devote like 8 months to that, you're pretty good. You get a full year of it under your belt. Now, obviously, there's refinements and whatnot, but to do this, like low level, even like lower level UFC stuff, part of the reason guys struggle when they get to the UFC is there's a bunch of skills that you're trying to develop. If you're already a lights out kickboxer and with a lot of experience at that, and Almeida is, if you can just dedicate boatloads of time to figuring out a couple of defensive things in these positions, and if you think I'm lying about this, look at Alex Pereira too. Open space, not the best wrestler. But he and Glover Teixeira helped him with this. Use that fence, man. That's your ally. Adesanya, same thing. Figured out how to use it. A lot of other guys are making those calls. So if you're the wrestler and that you see a guy with a lot of kickboxing credentials, you better be really good at fence wrestling in particular. Because if you get stalled out there, you're putting a lot of energy out, and you better be ready for that. So good enough for Almeida. And kicking everything off, Nora Quinol defeated Melissa Mullins via TKO. Nasty knees to 306 of the second. Some real nasty knees to the body from Quinol the whole fight. That's what set up the finish. She was throwing those things to the kidney. Which I love. Like, it's mean, but it's legal, so go for it. Some of them were coming straight up, like they're clinched up, and she's getting them up the middle, but anytime she could get kind of an angle on it, she'd wrap that around the back and, like, again, go to the kidney, which is just, ooh, it's so mean. Then finishing sequence, she catches Mullins with a knee right to the liver, straight up the middle, breaking a clinch. Mullins doubles over, gets head kicked, tries to walk away, gets head kicked again, and then we're done. Good stuff from Cornell there, seriously. Love some of those knees to the body she was doing. More kidney work, please. It's legal. Do it. It's mean, but it's legal. So thumbs up for that. That was the card. Your bonuses, I mentioned already, Fight of the Night officially went to Mariscal and Chartier. Not what I would have done, but I don't think it's undeserving. Performances, they were at a premium here, so they went to Ignacio Bahamondes and Cesar Almeida. They weren't going to give one to Cornol after missing weight, so at that point it's just okay. Do we give it to Almeida or Matsumoto? And kind of a coin flip, so that's what that was. Again, fairly pedestrian night of fights, for being honest, but it was a pedestrian card on paper, so not going to complain a whole lot there about that. But if you want my full report, it is in the MMA zone of 411 Mania, as usual. Give it a read, say hello, all of that good stuff, always, always appreciated. Alrighty. That's it for that. Oh, I got through that in a hurry. All right, let's move on then, shall we, to UFC 300 with the world's worst fight poster. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to bag too much on some of the UFC's promotional material these days, but this is the best you could do. Seriously? Ugh. But they will be in an arena full of people, and they have done everything they can to stack this card. It's pretty clear to me that this was not the original main event, for the record. But whatever they wanted couldn't come together because it feels very much like Alex Pereira and Jamal Hill were supposed to fight at UFC 301 because that's in Brazil. Couldn't quite, again, whatever they wanted for this top spot, they couldn't make it work. Whatever it happened to be. So they went with that, and 301 gets a main event that is very put together at the last minute. Not just I don't say that because it's a flyweight title fight. I would love more flyweight title fights in main events because it deserves it. But Pantoja and Steve Ursig, you get the distinct impression that Ursig was not the first guy they called for that, is all I'm saying. But anyway, 300 is a good card. It's a very good card. There's only a couple what am I not interested in here? Even the stuff I'm not personally all that interested in, I freely acknowledge has value. And that's how you know you've got a pretty darn good card. So, all right. Oh my, can I be honest, guys? I'm a little worried about my predictions here. I don't know how much. Some of these are very well matched fights. Some of these are very well matched fights. So, I'm nervous. It took a little bit to get my average back up. But, well, here we are. If it does damage to it, it does damage to it. All right, main event already mentioned, Alex Pereira and Jamal Hill. Jamal Hill, the former light heavyweight champion before he ruptured his Achilles tendon. And then we all know the sad saga of that title over the last, like, 18 months. Ultimately, Pereira defeated Jiří Procházka to claim the vacant belt. How do I see this going? There's a lot. Okay, so the odds on this are close. They tilt a little bit towards Pereira, like minus 130. Minus 150, minus 130. I think that's fair and accurate, but I think, here's the thing. I think that's so accurate that a lot of people are kind of ignoring, one, how close those are, and two, like, just how good Jamal Hill is. Jamal Hill is not a chump. Yes, he won that belt. He almost lost that fight in the last round of which would have been hilarious, especially since Glover said, yeah, if I'd won, I would have retired. Would have been hilarious. But neither here nor there. Hill didn't win that by accident. Okay? He's got a good UFC record. I think his only losses are like one of them was early to Paul Craig. Yeah, that's his only loss. When he in 2021 when he got his elbow injured pretty badly in that Craig fight. Since then, three stoppages in a row and the decision over Glover Teixeira. This is not somebody you should overlook. And because everyone is very confident, leaning ever so slightly to Jamal Hill, or excuse me, to Pereira, Jamal Hill's chances kind of get lost a little bit in that discussion. If everyone goes, feels pretty close, but Pereira, then you kind of don't talk about, well, what's Jamal Hill got for him? So Jamal Hill has good power, and Pereira's chin has been cracked before. Not impossible to hurt that man. We've seen Jamal Hill fight over 5 rounds. We've seen similar from Pereira, but he and Adesanya kind of agreed to a pace. They both like fighting around the same pace for the majority of the fight, so we haven't seen his cardio pushed in a way that, even though Glover got the dog snot beat out of him for a lot of that fight, he had to kind of go for a little bit in that. And then Thiago Santos actually sort of had a decent pace. So how this plays in the first round is not how it's going to play in the fifth round, is if it gets there, is kind of my point. So he's got power. He's a good straight hitter. So he doesn't do a lot of the really loopy, weird MMA style punching that a lot of guys do. Then, again, I think it's a mistake to discount him. All of which to say, I'm still leaning towards Pereira, like pretty much everyone else. I am very slightly leaning towards Pereira. It's not impossible to beat him in a striking match. It's really not. But I don't know if Jamal Hill can replicate what the people who have beaten him in purely striking matches have done. So again, that's kind of my question. And Hill is he's a little vulnerable to leg kicks, and something about how Pereira throws those calf kicks is just murder. It's just murder. So this is a lot closer than the discourse will lead you to believe. Because again, the discourse is you has been like, okay, we lean Pereira. Not a huge amount, but we all lean Pereira. And because we all lean Pereira, nobody's giving Hill much like the due he deserves. And I say that as a guy who doesn't care for his public persona. But his skills are legitimate. He's going to have to try and outstrike Alex Pereira. Because Hill's not much of a takedown threat. Not saying none, but not much of one. Clinch work will not necessarily favor him. And it's just a tough matchup for him. And I don't mind picking Pereira. I'm going to say something very similar about our co-main event. For the women's strawweight title, two-time champion Zhang Weili. Wait, out order on this? Yeah, that's next. Zhang Weili and Yan Xiaonan. First all Chinese title fight in UFC history, and they were thinking about trying to put this. They had to have tried to put this in China, and I don't know what's up with them and the Chinese government at the moment, but it's doesn't seem all that. I don't. It's not just the government. Like I don't know what the bureaucratic hurdles are, but they must be bureaucratic, because all other things being equal, the UFC likes the Chinese market. And had a potentially good fight for that market here that just circumstances must have conspired. And couldn't tell you what, but everything else about how the UFC tends to conduct business does lead me to believe that there's circumstances beyond their control may influencing this. So I'm gonna do what I did with Hill here. I'm gonna give Yan her due. Her only losses in the UFC, she got out wrestled and kind of beat up by Carlos Esparza, And then she dropped a split decision to Marina Rodriguez. And I kind of thought her fight with Dern should have been a draw, but ultimately it was a majority decision, and she knocked out Jessica Andrade her last time out. She's got power. She's a pretty good fighter from distance. Both women have a fair amount of Sanda in their background. They both throw that rear leg sidekick, very Sanda style. I can't describe it, but I've seen guys who throw that back leg sidekick like Savate style or karate style, and there's just a little bit about how the Sanda guys do it. That it's none of those are all the same, for the record. The Savate back leg sidekick, it's a back leg sachet. Not the same. I mean, it's functionally the same kick, but there's execution differences. And just, if you've seen a Sanda guy throw it, especially a Sanda guy in MMA, you know it. And again, I don't want to discount Yan here. She's got decent power. She's got good overall physical strength. But she was out-grappled by Mackenzie Dern, which is not the end of the world. She had some decent escapes, but Dern's control on the ground is also not really what Zhang's is. Zhang is a physical... Dude, if you've seen that woman pick up Shaquille O'Neal, you know how strong she is. That's a problem for a lot of people that face her. Her takedown game has improved a lot. She's got power, physically strong, five-round experience. The odds here are a little bit, I'd say, disrespectful. The odds are heavily with Zhang. She's like minus 500, give or take. That's a lot. That's just a lot. I don't know that I like her odds that heavily, but I do favor Zhang Weili. I'm just, if you look at those odds, you're going to be jaw on the floor shocked if Yan Xiaonan pulls this off. I will not be one of those people utterly befuddled by this outcome. I give Yan more credit than that. I still don't like her chances, but 5-1 in favor of Zhang, that's asking for trouble. Put it that way for the odds makers. That's asking for a little bit of trouble there. But I still favor Zhang. See how it plays out. Might be that they know more than I do. Maybe I'm a little bit gun-shy, all things considered, about some of these people who have been overlooked, because I've overlooked some people who have done serious damage. But... I take Yan more seriously than, like, plus 380. And I don't think that's an unfair thing to say. All right, next up for the symbolic BMF title. You know, Max Holloway got asked on Twitter, you know, who should... Because The Rock presented the first BMF belt to Jorge Masvidal. Then Gaethje just got it from, I think, whoever, when he beat... No, Masvidal gave it to him when he beat Poirier, didn't he? Have to double check. But the question was kind of asked, like, you know, somebody, you want to get this from somebody else who qualifies and it's not just a UFC suit. And Holloway said, well, yeah, sure, it should be Mark Coleman. Because, you know, the dude just saved his parents from a house fire and survived a couple of surgeries to remove soot from his lungs and whatnot. And is still up and back in the gym because Mark Coleman's a maniac. And Mark Coleman afterwards said, yeah, I'll be there, and I'm like the official backup for all these fights. And you kind of laugh at that because the man is old. But if they have Mark Coleman put that belt around whoever wins, you know what? Thumbs up. Mark Coleman saving his parents from a house fire after having like both hips replaced and a heart attack not too long ago, like, that man's a hero. And I don't say that lightly, but that was some heroic stuff he pulled. If he's the one handing that belt out this time around, you would be hard-pressed to make a better choice. The fight itself is between Justin Gaethje and Max Holloway, and, I mean, what do you want me to say here other than hook this into my veins? There's people in MMA fans who are not, like, big on the violence. I'm not a just bleed guy. I love me some good technique. But I love me some violence too, and I don't think those two things are mutually one, they're not mutually exclusive in terms of application of violence or technique to get to violence. And violence is a technique in and of itself in some respect. You've seen violent fighters, like there's just something about them. But you've got two action heroes, two gunslingers. Like there's what's not to love about this fight, unless you like both guys and can't stand to see either of them take brain trauma for the how much they're underpaid. And don't get me wrong, I understand that. I really do. Yeah, and I've started to struggle with that a little bit more lately. But again, love the fight. Couple of things about this. Max Holloway at lightweight is still something of an unknown proposition. He had some success in places against Poirier, but Poirier's firepower was a bit too much. Max didn't quite seem to have. He's not a. Look, Max is not a pillow fist guy, which, given the number of strikes he's landed over his career, you might be inclined to accuse him of a lack of punching power. He's not the hardest puncher in the world. Fair enough. But he's leaned into that and has embraced good power with high volume and accuracy, which, if you don't have, like, turn off the lights power, dial in your technique, know how to work in combination, like, watch Max Holloway. He will teach you how to fight if you don't have gobs of power. Another guy you can do for this, either of them, but actually because of how much more he's Nick Diaz, really good about this. If you're looking for like case studies about how to maximize lesser power while maximizing your chances of winning while still being a good striker. Like, there's guys who never accepted that they weren't big power punchers. Looking at you, Michael Bisping. That guy desperately wanted to hit like 20% harder, and he just never did. Still had success, bless him for it. Not hating on him, but the pillow fist allegations dogged Bisping for a while, and he got kind of salty about it earlier in his career. But he also was not a big puncher. He just wasn't. And unfortunately, for a lot of his career, he never embraced volume striking. He embraced a couple of shorter combinations that would have worked wonders if he was a big power puncher. But Max Holloway, not a big power puncher, but he will get you out of there because he will hit you cleanly and he will hit you a lot. But Max Holloway has also absorbed more strikes than anyone in UFC history. His defense has been a problem. That guy has lived on his chin. And he's been. Dude, he's never been hurt. Well, he's never been dropped. Sometimes people have hit him hard enough to make him back up. Poirier did in their second fight. Volkanovski got him their third fight. He got him to back up a couple of times. But in general, like, the man's chin is untouchable. He's got one of the best chins in the history of the sport. To have absorbed all those strikes and never really been knocked down. But he's fighting one of the most destructive strikers in the sport. There's not many people who have the raw firepower that Justin Gaethje launches at your head. Max's tactics are not talked about enough, but he has a very good team that is he is usually very well schooled. I expect him to have a good idea here. But it's not like Gaethje is just a caveman. What I would like to see if I'm looking for like what do I think each guy should really dial in on? Max needs to be a little bit lighter on his feet than he has been for a while. He can't be as settled. Needs to be in and out, needs to draw out Gaethje's attacks and then counter. Body work seems to usually be key against Gaethje. So pay attention to that. If you're Gaethje, I've mentioned this before, like Gaethje fights backwards from a lot of people. Mo conventional wisdom when it comes to striking is you jab first, expose weaknesses, draw out patterns, and then launch your bombs. That works for most people. Gaethje is the opposite. Gaethje throws bombs at you and then polishes you off after you're already hurt. I mean, he didn't really use his jab against Tony Ferguson until like the fourth and fifth rounds, and he broke him with it. He didn't use it in the first two rounds against Rafael Fiziev, and as soon as he did start using it, he tore him to pieces. Over 5 rounds, that's just a long time to fight Justin Gaethje, man. It really is. I'm not. I'm picking Gaethje. I love both guys. These are two of my favorite fighters to watch for entertainment. They're two of my favorite fighters to watch for technique. I love these guys. I love this fight. It breaks my heart to pick one of them. But Max, ultimately, man, Max's defense is just kind of an issue. He's gotten away with a lot of it. The leg kicks might be a problem for him too. If Gaethje can replicate elements of what Yair Rodriguez did, Max will be in serious trouble. Because Max did okay in the striking versus Rodriguez, but he had some problems there. He got by on that fight by surprisingly out-wrestling him. I don't know that he's going to out-wrestle Gaethje. I'm going with Gaethje. I love the fight. I love the violence. I hope neither man comes out of this irreparably damaged, is my big hope. I struggled with this next one, man. Still at lightweight, we have Charles Oliveira, former champion, and Armin Saryukian. Why have I struggled with this one? Oliveira is. He's Oliveira. I mean, he's the most prolific finisher in UFC history. Former champion, big ol' win streak until he ran into Islam Makhachev. It was just a nightmare matchup for him, in all honesty. Coming off a win over Beneil Dariush. I mean, prior to that Makhachev loss, he hadn't lost since Paul Felder elbowed his head into the mat in 2017. Some of those were easier wins than others, for the record. But still went out there and got it done. Here's the thing about Oliveira, and I don't mean this unkindly. A lot of people are terrified of his guard. And I'm not saying you shouldn't be respectful of it. You should. But Oliveira's reputation as a submission threat, I'm not saying it's overstated, it's misunderstood more often than not. He has an active guard, but he can be smothered from there. He can be, if you know what you're doing, you don't, again, you need to be respectful and aware, you don't need to be terrified of his guard. Beneil Dariush was not afraid of his guard. And Beneil Dariush's problems in that fight were not related to the ground. That's where that ultimately kind of led into the finish, but that wasn't the big problem. Islam Makhachev beat him up on the ground. Now, it's easy to say, oh, that's Islam Makhachev. Yes, it is. I say all that to say Armin Saryukian is not going to be afraid of his ground game. That may be a problem if he is not respectful of it, but he is not going to be afraid to wrestle him. And Oliveira's mental edge in getting people to refuse to engage with him on the ground at all, because they fought a lot of guys who weren't competent enough there. But Kevin Lee had good success against him on the ground. Didn't go his way ultimately, but he found success there. It's tough because there's a lot of what Saryukian does that still gives even current iteration of Charles Oliveira problems. But Oliveira is still in general an offensive dynamo. If Saryukian can't get him down and force him into jiu-jitsu mode, Oliveira's clinch game is really good. He's good about throwing knees. He's good about throwing in elbows. He's got power. It's sneaky power because it kind of, again, you don't quite expect it. His de Oliveira's defense on the feet is still kind of an issue, but this is the thing. Like, you saw Poirier drop him, Gaethje dropped him, and what did they do? They did not go down into his guard. Either they were afraid of it, or they didn't think they'd hurt him badly enough. Oliveira had such an aura around this that he got people in MMA to give him a standing eight count. If you get dropped and the other guy says, "Nope, not going down," the referee looks at you and says, "Get up." As long as you're okay, getting up, you don't get the full standing eight count, which can go on for a while, but that there was such respect slash fear for that position with that guy that people would hurt him and then take, your 3, 4 seconds to recover while you regain your feet because I don't want to be down there with you. When you take away that element of how you fight Charles Oliveira, very different fight. Very different. Now, look, could Oliveira submit me 18 times in 3 minutes? Probably less. You can submit me 18 times in 1 minute. Like, I am nobody next to this guy. But I'm not Armin Saryukian either. And if I'm Armin Saryukian, I think ultimately I do. Hang on. What's my deciding factor going to be here? Oliveira's only 34. He'll be 35 in October. Saryukian's 27. Oliveira's starting to hit the downside. Not majorly, but past the peak. Saryukian's starting to get there. That's another big factor. Saryukian was given Makhachev. Rewatch that fight with Saryukian and Makhachev, by the way. Heck of a lot of wrestling. Not just takedowns, I mean wrestling. The odds are actually with Saryukian. I can understand why. I really can. There's a lot about this matchup that has troubled Oliveira in the past. In the recent past, mind you, not even like distant past. If this were 5 rounds, I would actually favor Oliveira. Not that Saryukian can't fight into the 5th round, we've seen him do it, but the more time you have to spend dealing with the danger that Oliveira presents, the worse off you are. The 3 rounds thing is actually kind of convincing me to go with the odds and lean towards Saryukian. Am I really? Spent a lot of time talking about it, haven't I? Spent a lot of time talking myself into that. Is a very close fight, very well matched, very even. I'm still. I'm gonna buck the odds and go with Oliveira. But I don't know about that one. I don't know about that one. What's my other cause for hesitance here? It's not like, dude, it's not like Saryukian's ever been finished. Both Makhachev and Mateusz Gamrot beat him by decision. Now, neither of those guys are the caliber of finisher that Oliveira is, but you know what? I'm gonna stick with Oliveira. I am. If I eat the L, I eat the L. Right. Might feel real bad about this one, and if I'm wrong about this one, I will kick myself over it. But There's a little bit of Saryukian's def. There's a large part of Saryukian's defense that is his offense. Meeting offense with Charles Oliveira is a problem. But I can easily see Saryukian out-wrestling Oliveira. Easily. You know what? That's the real question. Is Saryukian going to entertain prolonged striking exchanges with Oliveira? That's where he'll get in real trouble. If he's going to get in trouble, that's where it's going to start. If he comes out and is immediately looking to not just clinch, but clinch to takedown, I think he might entertain a bit too much striking. And again, man, Oliveira's distance closer is always that flying knee. And that's just asking for trouble. I know why the odds are where they are. I know why the odds are where they are. But I'm going to go with Oliveira, and I'm just going to be wrong if I'm wrong. A fight I must equivocate and wonder over much less is our main card opener, Bo Nickel and Cody Brundage. Bo Nickel is a minus 2,000 to minus 3,000 favorite, depending on where you look. There's good reason for this. I don't think Cody Brundage is some kind of scrub. He has wins in the UFC. He's just got a lot of losses to a lot of guys who do stuff similar to Bo Nickel. And he's gonna. I don't have a good reason to pick against Bo Nickel in this fight. I just don't. So I'm not. Moving on. Light heavyweights might crown your next title contender here. I also feel like this is your backup fight. If something happens to either Pereira or Hill before this card, either of these two could slot into that main event spot. You've got Jiří Prochazka, former champion, and Alexander Rakic. Prochazka coming off of the loss to Pereira. Before that, he had a long winning streak going back to 2015. And he looked okay against Pereira in places. He just looked a touch rusty. And Pereira is a very good fighter. Meanwhile, we have Rakic coming back from a knee injury. I've been fairly high on Rakic in the past. I thought he beat Volkan Ozdemir. His fights with Anthony Smith and Thiago Santos, they were clean wins, but they were not inspiring wins. Then he was going okay with Blachowicz. I think they were around a piece going into the third. And then his knee gave out, just random knee injury. Really unfortunate. He's been out for almost 2 years. It was May of 22. It's a long layoff. The layoff's a problem, and getting welcomed back by Jiří Prochazka, that's a problem too. I thought, look, one of my friend Pat, actually, years ago said, that Rakic guy, pay attention to him. He's got what it takes. And I take Pat's assessment of talent very seriously. So I've kind of been paying attention to him. Again, that knee injury was really unfortunate. The layoff's a problem. This is a really tough fight back. I don't know. Prochazka's chin has been cracked a lot. Even fights he's won, we've seen him get hurt and dropped. Rakic is actually a slight favorite in most places. I don't know, man. I don't like picking against Yerdy. He's good. Rakic is good. Yerdy is hard to predict. It's kind of the thing. He's really hard to predict. Not necessarily outcomes, but like methodology, how the fight goes. All that kind of stuff. I'm actually gonna go with I'm gonna go with Yuri. Because I don't want to spell out Prochazka for this. I'm gonna go with Prochazka, but it's a lot to lay off. Under other circumstances, if this were Rakit, like say he had gotten a win over someone like way down in the top 15 as his fight back, and this was his second fight back under these circumstances, I would probably pick Rakic. And under different conditions, I actually would. But let me go with Prochazka here and just be prepared to feel like an idiot. Another fight I have to be prepared to feel like an idiot on. Calvin Kattar and Aljamain Sterling. This is a featherweight fight. Former bantamweight champion Sterling moving up in weight. I think Sterling is your favorite. Where are you? There you are. Yeah, Sterling's the favorite. I can kind of see that. Look, Kattar's a very good fighter. I thought he beat Josh Emmett when that fight happened. He's coming off that knee injury though when he fought Arnold Allen. That might be a thing. That might be a thing. Here's my reticence about just picking Sterling. A lot of Sterling's game relies on him being physically stronger than you, which I'm not sure he is at featherweight. And utilizing a long game of reach advantage at distance before crashing distance and grappling you. That's very broad strokes, but those are the broad points of his game. And there's stuff that works into that, obviously, and he's obviously very good at it. But he's not a pocket fighter. He's not a combination fighter. He picks at you from the outside with long range weaponry, because you're normally at a reach and height disadvantage to him. Then, when you try to close distance, or when you're a little bit befuddled by that, he closes distance, and he's able to out wrestle and out grapple. He was able to do that to the entire bantamweight division, pretty much. I don't know how well that game is going to translate up a weight class because some of the conditions he is used to enjoying and the preconditions for his style's success are not necessarily in play. And by way of example, Calvin Kattar's 5'11 with a 72-inch reach. Sterling is 5'7 with 71 inches, so he's going to be at a height disadvantage. He's not used to that. He'll technically be at a reach disadvantage, but it's more the height and general range that are gonna, if something's gonna throw him off, I think it's that. That's how Sean O'Malley beat him. That's a gross oversimplification for the record. But if you look at, like, how did Sean O'Malley beat Aljamain Sterling? The preconditions for Sterling's success were not there. He couldn't close distance. He couldn't corral O'Malley, and he couldn't pick at him from distant from range because O'Malley was actually taller and a little bit rangier, and it messed with everything Sterling was trying to do. Now, Kattar doesn't fight the same way that O'Malley does, but I don't know if Sterling's going to have radically shifted up his game at this point to address some of these issues. Kattar's only 36. He's got more than 36 years worth of mileage on his body from some of the fights he's been in. Dude was on the wrong end of a historic beating against Max Holloway. Sterling doesn't have that kind of mileage on him. But I don't know that 145 is actually going to be a refuge for Sterling at this point. I'm actually going with Kattar. Not by a lot. And man, I mentioned this already previously. I've only gone negative once on my picks all year. This might be another one. This is really kind of shaping up that way in my head. Some of these fights, man. Speaking of some of these fights, women's bantamweight, former champion Holly Holm and UFC debutante and two-time Olympic gold medalist in judo, Kayla Harrison, is going to square up. I don't know what to expect out of this one. Holly Holm at age 42, still being competitive is kind of both a kudos to her and a little bit of an indictment on the division. She got choked out by Myra Buena Silva last time out. They got changed to a no contest. Buena Silva had a failed a drug test for ADHD medication, which I understand kind of why that's on the prohibited list, but man, we got to get better about some of this stuff. But she beat Yana Santos before that, had a tough fight with Ketlin Vieira before that, and it was split. She's not fallen off a cliff the way you might have expected after a certain point in her career. And Kayla Harrison only has one loss. She lost a unanimous decision to Larissa Pacheco. That was their like second or third their third fight. She was 2-0 against her before that. Her entire career has been in the PFL. And on the off chance, if you're curious, her Olympic golds came in 2012 and 2016. I mean, her overall listed judo record here is 25, is, excuse me, 45 and 7. Which is a lot of those are all right. So I'm Harrison at 135. I don't know. She's been, I mean, her judo career took place at 100 and it was what, 78 kilos? That's what, 170 pounds, give or take. Her weight cut to lightweight is not the hardest thing in the world, but it's a cut. And then she made featherweight once. I mean, she had one fight in Invicta when she went down to featherweight and murdered a woman. But it's been lightweight since then. Her at bantamweight is a giant unknown. But Holly is hard to get a hold of. I could easily see this being just Holly able to keep distance fighting on the outside. It's not like Holly's clinch game is a joke either. It's not what it's certainly not going to be what Kayla's is. Harrison's a significant favorite, actually. Look, I'm not saying I don't see the logic in favoring her, but 4.5 to 1? Dude, you pay out 3.5 to 1 on Holly Holm in this kind of fight? You're asking for, let me say that the second time I'm saying it, that's asking for trouble. It is entirely possible for Holly Holm to keep this fight at distance and just if you're a gambling man and you still have those odds and you again, if you don't mind losing, that's something to consider. I think I'm still going to favor Harrison. Holly's habit of clinching up, yeah, that might bite her here. You can't clinch with Kayla Harrison as a general rule. So I'm gonna pick Harrison, but that's asking, those odds are not reflective of what I think is the mo like, those are not reflective of how close I think the fight is. Featherweight Sadiq Yusuff and Diego Lopez. This should be fun. Yusuff coming off a loss to Edson Barboza, it was a good fight. It was a really good fight. He's only lost in the UFC to Arnold Allen and the aforementioned Edson Barboza. He likes to fight at a slightly more deliberate pace. Diego Lopez had a tough UFC debut on short notice against Movsar Evloev and gave him problems. Pretty easily won his last two fights over Gavin Tucker, excuse me, and Pat Sabatini. My gut says actually to consider Lopez here. The odds agree with me. Yeah, not discounting Sadiq Yusuff, he's good. He's very good. But His cardio has been a question mark in the past. It wasn't the Barboza fight. And Lopez fights at a very, very high pace. I'm going with Lopez. Not by a lot, but I'm okay leaning there. Lightweight, Jalen Turner and Renato Moicano. I don't know about this one, man. Moicano won his last two over Brad Riddell and Drew Dober. The Dober one in particular, that was nothing to sneeze at. He's 4-1 in his last five. The only loss, he took a pretty bad beating against Rafael dos Anjos, but that was short notice. Lightweight's done okay for him. Fiziev knocked him out, and then dos Anjos beat him down, but he beat Jai Herbert, Alexander Hernandez, and then the aforementioned Brad Riddell and Drew Dober. Moicano's good. Jalen Turner, though, is a large man. 6'3" at lightweight. 77 inches of reach. Coming off of his two losses, split decisions to Gamrot and Hooker. The Gamrot case I thought was stronger for him winning. I agreed that Hooker won that fight. Dude, Hooker gutted through a tough fight in that one to get that done in the end. But he knocked out Bobby Green his last time out. Looked real good in that fight. I'm torn on this one, man. I am just kind of torn. And how big exactly is Moicano? 5'11", so he's giving up 4 inches of height and 5 and change in reach. Yeah, let me go with Turner. Ugh, I don't. The mileage might be catching up to Moicano a little bit too. I'm not. He's got good wins recently. I'm not trying to discount that, but Turner really seems to be kind of finding himself, whereas I think we've seen the best of Moicano. Women's strawweight, Jessica Andrade and Marina Rodriguez. I don't know about this one, man. Rodriguez beat Michelle Waterson Gomez her last time out. Andrade really seems to be a little bit. Look, she had a rough stretch. Losing to Erin Blanchfield, that was short notice. Got knocked out by Yan Xiaonan, that was bad. Got kind of run over by Tatiana Suarez, but in Blanchfield, one of the best flyweights. Yan currently fighting for the belt, and Suarez, one of the great what could have beens, in all honesty. She stopped Mackenzie Dern her last time out. I mean, here's the thing about Andrade. She's only 32, which is shockingly young, considering she has 37 fights and has a UFC tenure dating back to 2013. She was part of the first, wasn't she part of the first ever UFC women's fight? I might be wildly misremembering. I think I am. Now, Carmouche and Rousey might have been the. No, that Carmouche and Rousey was actually the first. I don't know. And I don't care to look it up, so I apologize if I'm erroneously remembering. But maybe this wasn't that got Carmouche the title fight? Hang on. No, I think that was after. Pretty sure that was after. It does not matter. I'm not bothering to look this up. But that's a lot of mileage on Andrade. And I'm going to lean towards her. Rodriguez does some really good striking. That's kind of primarily what she does. And Andrade can be hit and can be hurt, but I don't know that I've seen Rodriguez have to react to the power that Andrade brings, and that's just different. So this is close, but I'm going to lean towards Andrade. And just another one I might be very, very wrong about. Lightweight Bobby Green and Jim Miller. Can't complain about this fight. You know me, guys. I know it's emotional. I know it's emotional. But I'm picking Jim Miller. Bobby Green coming off that loss to Turner. He won a couple of good fights before that over Tony Ferguson and Grant, the Grant Dawson one in particular. But Miller can still go. And I'm not going to be surprised if Bobby Green wins. I think he's your favorite, so I'm not really capable of being of sound, accurate prediction when it comes to Jim Miller at this point. I think this is winnable for either guy. I think it'll be a good fight. But I'm riding with Miller. And if it screws up my ratio, it screws up my ratio. I can live with that. And kicking everything off at bantamweight, Davison Figueiredo and Cody Garbrandt. The best version of Cody Garbrandt wins this fight. But Cody Garbrandt's a bit chinny. He's been suckered into some really disadvantageous positions in his last couple of fights, even though he won. He's got power, but he's kind of a glass cannon. His defense when he's thinking and on point is good. When his ego gets involved, his defense kind of goes away. And that's when he gets hurt. He struggled dealing with the calf kicks from Brian Kelleher, and Figueiredo's not shy about throwing those. Davison Figueiredo at bantamweight, I wasn't sold on this when he announced that move up. Like, a new flyweight was a hard weight cut, but I wasn't sure how much success he'd have. He relied a lot at flyweight on being a big puncher, physically strong, good enough technically, but there's just some physical advantages he leaned on that I wasn't sure he'd have. Turns out he kind of does. He's still a little bit rangy. He's on the smaller end of the bantamweight scale, but he's not undersized. He's got the physical strength. He's still got power. At one point, Garbrandt was talking about cutting down and fighting Figueiredo for the flyweight belt. Garbrandt tore his bicep and dodged a bullet. Figueiredo would have hurt him at flyweight, turns out. I don't like Garbrandt's chances here. I think this is a tough matchup for him. Figueiredo, that's the other thing about this, man. Figueiredo's tough. He's eaten some shots from some guys who have decent pop. Now, Garbrandt, probably the hardest puncher he's ever faced, so needs to be acknowledged there, but this is a tough fight for Garbrandt, and I kind of like Figueiredo's chances, so that's where we are with that. Saturday, MMAZone411mania.com. Stop by, say hello, give it a listen. You know how that works. And I always, always appreciate any and all of that that you guys can give me. All right. Yeah, that took a bit. But big card, a lot of fights worth devoting some time to. So, but let's move on, shall we? So, news broke yesterday. So, the UFC's new drug testing partner is Drug Free Sport International, DFSI. This is the same group that, like, most major sporting organizations use. And if you know anything about the drug testing policies of most major sporting organizations, you know why that's kind of, not that I care, I'm just saying. So, John Jones, UFC heavyweight champion, got into a little bit of hot water here. There was a police report filed against him by one of the drug testers for this company who claim he threatened her and took her phone and, again, threatened violence. And just feel free to find the whole thing if you want. I'm summarizing here. Now, John has a counterclaim here. So that report was filed. There's a summons out for John right now that doubles as an arrest. He has not been taken into custody. Because there was misleading headlines about John Jones arrested. He's not been arrested. He's not in custody. The summons related to this is very serious, and it can kind of double, so that's a whole, there's it's a legal subcategory of how you can choose to handle some of these things. So that's how they've chosen to handle this one. So John does have a court date, that's going to be a thing, but John has a different version of events where the drug tester showed up and was unprofessional, and there's allegations that John was intoxicated. I don't think those are too much in dispute. There was a party he was celebrating a friend's birthday or something, and he was in his own home. He was not, to the extent that one can view the consumption of alcohol as responsible, to the best of all available information, he was not being irresponsible. I'd rather no one drank ever, but that's just me. Well, not just me, but that is my opinion. So he's making some counterclaims of unprofessional conduct and stuff along those lines, which is may well be true. I don't know. And there's some video that was from, like, 'cause he's got, the doorbell camera basically, that shows the departure of the two people who were there for the drug test or whatnot, and him, and it seems amicable. I don't know. John Jones does not have a lot of doubt, a lot of benefits of the doubt, does he at this point? Can we? We should be able to say that. Like, this is not a guy with a lot of chances left in that respect. So I don't know what happened. The counter statement from John, he's not making ridiculous allegations, and let's be very clear about the following. It's not like either this drug testing agency or any other drug testing agency has never had accusations not dissimilar to what John has levied against them, be levied against them. Some of these places are rife with unprofessional behavior. I mean, there was a guy who, like, this was from USADA, who, when he was there to collect Jose Aldo's sample, got a selfie with him. That is not your job, sir. You're there to collect a sample. Be a professional. What are you doing? So there's that. So with the understanding that if you were to put a gun to my head and say, who do you think's telling the truth? I don't know how much credibility John has in the absence of serious evidence to the contrary. But I am not here to pass judgment on this one way or the other until more information comes out. This is just to say that John Jones is once again in a legal conundrum. And if this goes sideways for him, and that man has dodged some serious bullets, but you can't dodge those forever. If this one goes sideways on him, Tom Aspinall becoming UFC heavyweight champion via John being stripped again is not out of the question. So we'll keep an eye on this as it develops, per usual, but that's where we are. I was going to talk about that, but I'm not going to at the moment. I don't want to be here forever. You already know how long this is. I don't yet. So Dustin Poirier claims he gets the next title shot against Islam Makhachev, or that's what's being targeted slash in the works. He's put out there that that's a thing, so we'll have to wait and see. I don't like lightweight being log jammed. It's too good a division. And you've got two potential title contender fights happening at UFC 300. You've got, allegedly, this is that your title eliminator will be Oliveira and Saryukian. We all know that if Gaethje and Holloway wins, and there's like, it's whoever wins that could easily, especially if it's Gaethje. But depending on the timing, because the UFC is beholden to the machinery, if putting those two fights on this one card means that the next time they need the lightweight belt in rotation, either no one's going to be eligible, I'm not going to complain about Dustin Poirier getting a title shot. I'm just not. I don't like his chances against Makhachev. I don't like anyone's chances against Islam Makhachev. But if Dustin Poirier pulls this off, that will be the best feeling moment MMA has produced in years. and years. Assuming the fight even comes to fruition. But that's where we are with that. A little bit of behind-the-scenes kind of business news here up next. It's not a big deal, but I think it's worth noting. Endeavor, the parent company of the TKO Group, formerly WME, the talent agency, and now live entertainment conglomerate, maybe? They're still a talent agency, but the corporate structuring is a little bit weird. But anyway, they went public a handful of years ago, and the stock market kind of laughed at them. And this last week, they agreed to have like 51%, like the voting interest, the controlling interest, was bought by a very prominent investor group, Silver Lake, who then took them off of the market and made them private. Which is not uncommon. It's a kind of a big whatever. The Endeavor stock was not, was not doing all that great. I'm not saying it was bad, but like it clearly was not what the shareholders wanted out of that was not what they got. Don't think that's unfair to say. For those of you wondering about, wait a minute, what about TKO? Again, Endeavor has multiple holdings. The TKO Group, which comprises the UFC and the WWE, is among the things they have controlling interest in. At the moment, TKO is still publicly traded. It's been a little bit up and down. I mean, for reasons that are entirely understandable, because the stock market is a bit volatile. But at the moment, TKO is still publicly traded. The parent company is now a private entity once again, and I don't expect this to play much to anything, but it's worth enough noting that it happened, and y'all should be aware. Technically now, the owner of the UFC is owned by this investment group, Silver Lake, which owns a bunch of stuff. It's like, any of these other major, like, hedge fund investment doohickeys that, frankly, I could do without as far as the how a lot of the financial stuff is structured worldwide, but that's a whole other conversation that we don't need to get into here, do we? Okay. Again, I was going to talk a little bit about PFL season starting, but that's such a... very briefly. I hate that a large part of the health of the MMA landscape is kind of tied to the PFL, but if the PFL can't make it as a viable competitor to the UFC, then it is physically, structurally impossible for anything to challenge them. And their monopolistic status needs to be acknowledged and dealt with in some respect. But, yeah. On a lighter news week, I might talk a little bit about Josh Barnett's appearance on the MMA Hour and some of his suggestions for MMA structurally, but we're 90 plus minutes in. I'm going to check Twitter, see if anything crazy is broken. If not, we'll do plugs and get out of here. Okay. Nope. Nothing new there. My feed is currently full of General Conference and WrestleMania highlights because those are the people I follow, and that's what happened over the weekend. So there's all that. And none of that is what I'm here to talk about, so plugs. All right. There is no Damn You Hollywood this week. For whatever reason, we're taking a week off. We could have talked Monkey Man, but we're taking a week off. Not the end of the world. Last week, we talked about Godzilla Kong, the new Empire. Tune in for our review of that, if you're so inclined. That movie seems like it's going to struggle a little bit. Strong opening weekend, but precipitous drop. Next week will be Civil War, because that's what Mark wanted to talk about. So, yeah. Kind of a look, man, there's just stuff. It's kind of a weak month. It's kind of a weak month for movies. So we'll make do with what we got. What do we have this month? Civil War, Abigail, and then the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. So I don't expect any of these to set the world on fire. Yeah, it's kind of a ultimate point there.
But again, if you want to listen to our Godzilla Kong review, that's me, Mark Radulich, and Alexis Haina. Then Civil War next week, not this week. So yeah, tune in for that. I'll talk more about that next week when I do the review preview. I cover mixed martial arts and professional wrestling over at 411mania.com. So WWE SmackDown on Friday. The fallout from WrestleMania will continue because that, again, just wrapped up. And UFC 300 on Saturday. So, see y'all then. We'll be back here reviewing UFC 300. There is no event the week after. They're taking a week off. Not the worst idea in the world. And in 2 weeks from Saturday, they'll be back with an ESPN card at the warehouse. What is worth? Hang on, how is this? Okay. This is not going to set the world on fire, but this is not the worst card. Matthews Nicolau and Alex Perez, okay, as your main event. Joel Alvarez and Mateusz Rembeski. That I'm looking, actually kind of looking forward to. I usually like Rani Yahya. Victor Henry's not a bad opponent. What else do we got? Gabriel Benitez and Mahashate. Kind of curious about Mahashate. Austin Hubbard's fighting, and Hubbard's usually good for a fight. Don't know if I should care about Ryan Spann and Bogdan Guskov. Probably not. It's light heavyweight. Of course, I shouldn't care about it. Again, this is not going to be a great card. It's not going to set the world on fire. But in fairness to it at the moment, not the worst card the UFC's put out on paper this year. So that's as glowing as my praise gets for the warehouse fights, I guess. All right. That's it for me. Thank you all very much. Back here next week for the review of UFC 300. Tune in then. Should be a good time. Thank you all again for listening. I appreciate the heck out of you. Stay safe out there and continue to be well, be safe, and behave.